Air Force Base to go over and establish continuous radar coverage, plus a lot of fighters to do bar cap. Once that's done, we'll think about what missions we'll want to fly. Mainly defensive at first, until we get firmly established. Moore didn't have to explain to Jackson that there was more to moving an Air Force than just the aircraft. With each fighter squadron went mechanics, ordnance men, and even air traffic controllers. A fighter plane might have only one pilot, but it needed an additional 20 or more personnel to make it a functioning weapon. For more complex aircraft, the numbers just went higher.
"What about SyncPak?" Jackson asked.
"We can give their Navy a serious headache. Mancuso's moving his submarines and other ships."
"These images aren't all that great," Ryan observed, looking down at the radar overheads.
"We'll have visuals late tomorrow," Ed Foley told him.
"Okay, when we do, we'll have to show them to NATO. See what they'll do to help us out."
First Armored has orders to stand by to entrain. The German railroads are in better shape today than they were in 1990 for Desert Shield, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs informed them. "We can change trains just east of Berlin. The Russian railroads have a different gauge. It's wider. That actually helps us, wider cars for our tracks to ride on. We figure we can move First Armored to the far side of the Urals in about 7 days."
"Who else?" Ryan asked.
"Not sure," Moore answered.
"The Brits will go with us.
Them we can depend on," Adler told them all. "And Grushevoy was talking to their prime minister. We need to talk to Downing Street to see what developed from that."
"Okay, Scott, please look into that.
But first let's get that note drafted for Beijing."
"Right," Sexstate agreed and headed for the door.
"Jesus, I hope we can get them to see sense," Ryan said to the maps and imagery before his eyes.
"Me too, Jack," the vice president agreed. "But don't bet the farm on it."
What Adler had said to him on the flight from Warsaw came back to him. If only America still had ballistic missiles, deterrence would have been far easier. But Ryan had played a role in eliminating the damn things, and it seemed a very strange thing for him to regret now.
The note was generated and sent to the embassy in Beijing in less than 2 hours. The deputy chief of mission, or DCM, in the embassy was a career foreign service officer named William Kilmer. The formal note arrived as email, and he had a secretary print it up in proper form and on expensive paper, which was folded into an envelope of creamy texture for hand delivery. He called the Chinese Foreign Ministry, requesting an urgent meeting with Foreign Minister Shen Tang. This was granted with surprising alacrity, and Kilmer walked to his own automobile, a Lincoln Town Car, and drove himself to the ministry. Kilmer was in his middle 30s, a graduate of the College of William and Mary in Virginia and Georgetown University in Washington. A man on his way up, his current position was rather ahead of his years, and the only reason he'd gotten it was that Ambassador Carl Hitch had been expected to be a particularly good mentor for bringing him along from AAA ball into the bigs. This mission, delivering this note, made him think about just how junior he was. But he couldn't very well run from the job, and career-wise he was taking a big step. Assuming he didn't get shot. Unlikely, but... The walk to Shen's office was a lonely one. The corridor seemed to stretch into infinity as he stepped down it in his best suit and shiny black shoes. The building and its appointments were supposed to be imposing, to show representatives of foreign countries just how impressive the People's Republic of China was. Every country did it this way, some better than others. In this case, the architect had earned his money, Kilmer thought. Finally, but sooner than he'd expected when he'd begun, he found the door and turned right to enter the secretary's anteroom. Shen's male executive assistant led the American into a more comfortable waiting room and fetched water for him. Kilmer waited for the expected 5 minutes, because you didn't just barge in to see a senior government minister of a major power. But then the high doors—they were always double doors at this level of diplomacy—opened, and he was beckoned in. Shen was wearing a Mao jacket today instead of the usual Western-style business suit, a dark blue in color. He approached his guest and extended his hand.
"Mr. Kilmer, a pleasure to see you again."
"Thank you for allowing this impromptu audience, Minister."
"Please have a seat."
Shen waved to some chairs surrounding the usual low table. When both of them were seated, Shen asked,
"What can I do for you this day?"
"Minister, I have a note from my government to place into your hand." With that, Kilmer pulled the envelope from his coat pocket and handed it across. The envelope was not sealed. Shen withdrew the 2-page diplomatic message and leaned back to read it. His face didn't alter a dot before he looked up.
"This is a most unusual communication, Mr. Kilmer."
"Minister, my government is seriously concerned with recent deployments of your military."
"The last note delivered from your embassy was an insulting interference in our internal affairs. Now you threaten us with war?"
"Sir, America makes no threats. We remind you that since the Russian Federation is now a signatory of the North Atlantic Treaty, any hostilities directed at Russia will compel America to honor her treaty commitments."
"And you threaten the senior members of our government if something untoward should happen to Americans in our country?"
"What do you take us for, Mr. Kilmer?" Shen asked in an even, unexcited voice. "Minister, we merely point out that, as America extends to all of our visitors the protection of our laws, we hope that the People's Republic will do the same."
"Why should we treat American citizens any differently from the way we treat our own?"
"Minister, we merely request your assurance that this will be the case."
"Why should it not be the case? Do you accuse us of plotting a war of aggression against our neighbor?"
"We take note of recent military actions by the People's Republic and request clarification."
"I see."
Shen folded the papers back up and set them on the table.
"When do you request a reply?"
"As soon as you find it convenient to do so, Minister," Kilmer answered.
"Very well. I will discuss this matter with my colleagues on the Politburo and reply to you as quickly as we can."
"I will convey that good news to Washington, Minister." "I will not take more time from your day, sir. Thank you very much indeed for your time." Kilmer stood and shook hands one more time. Kilmer walked through the anteroom without a glance left or right, turned left in the corridor, and headed toward the elevators. The corridor seemed just as long for this little walk, he thought, and the clicking of his heels on the tile floor seemed unusually loud. Kilmer had been an FSO long enough to know that Shen should have reacted more irately to the note. Instead, he had received it like an invitation to an informal dinner at the embassy. That meant something, but Kilmer wasn't sure what. Once in his car, he started composing his dispatch to Foggy Bottom, then quickly realized that this was something he'd better report by voice first over the stew. "How good is he, Carl?" Adler asked the ambassador.
"He's an okay kid, Scott. Photographic memory, talent I wish I had. Maybe he was promoted a little fast, but he's got the brains he needs, just a little short on field experience. I figure in another 3 years or so he'll be ready to run his own embassy and start his way up the ladder."
In a place like Lesotho, Sextate thought, which was a place to make backwater seem a compliment. Well, you had to start somewhere.
"How will Shen react?"
"Depends. If they're just maneuvering troops on routine training, they might be a little angry. If it's for real and we've caught them with their hands in the cookie jar, they'll act hurt and surprised." Hitch paused for a yawn.
"Excuse me. The real question is whether it'll make them think things over."
"Will it? You know most of them."
"I don't know," Hitch admitted uncomfortably.
"Scott, I've been there a while, sure, but I can't say that I fully understand them. They make decisions on political considerations that Americans have a hard time comprehending."
"The president calls them Klingons," Adler told the ambassador.
Hitch smiled.
I wouldn't go that far, but there is logic in the observation.
Then Adler's intercom buzzed. "Call from William Kilmer in Beijing on the stew, Mr. Secretary," the secretary's voice said.
"This is Scott Adler," Sextate said when he lifted the phone. "Ambassador Hitch is here with me. You're on speaker."
"Sir, I made the delivery. Minister Shen hardly blinked. He said he'd get back to us soon, but not exactly when, after he talked it over with his Politburo colleagues. Aside from that, not much of a reaction at all. I can fax you the transcript in about half an hour. The meeting didn't last 10 minutes.
Adler looked over at Hitch, who shook his head and didn't look happy at the news.
"Bill, how was his body language?" Hitch asked.
"Like he was on Prozac, Carl. No physical reaction at all."
"Shen tends to be a little hyperactive," Hitch explained. "Sometimes he has trouble sitting still."
"Conclusions, Bill?"
"I'm worried," Kilmer replied at once. "I think we have a problem here."
"Thank you, Mr. Kilmer. Send the facts quick as you can."
Adler punched the phone button and looked at his guest.
"Oh, shit."
"Yeah. How soon will we know how they're going to react to this?"
"Tomorrow morning, I hope.
We have a source inside their government?" Hitch asked.
The blank look he got in reply was answer enough.
"Thanks, Scott," Ryan said, hanging up the phone.
He was back in the Oval Office now, sitting in his personally fitted swivel chair, which was about as comfortable as any artifact could make him. It didn't help much at the moment, but he supposed it was one less thing to worry about.
"So?"
"So we wait to see if Zorga tells us anything."
"Zorga?" Professor Weaver asked.
"Dr. Weaver, we have a sensitive source of information that sometimes gives us information on what their Politburo is thinking," Ed Foley told the academic.
"And that information does not leave this room."
"Understood."
Academic or not, Weaver played by the rules.
"That's the name for the special stuff you've been showing me?"
"Correct."
"It's a hell of a source, whoever it is. It reads like a tape of their meetings, captures their personalities. Especially Zhang. He's the real bad actor here. He's got Premier Xu pretty well wrapped around his little finger."
"Adler's met him during the shuttle talks after the Airbus shoot down at Taipei," Ryan said.
"And?" Weaver asked.
"He knew the name and the words, but not the man."
"And he's powerful and not a terribly nice chap," the president answered. "He had a role in our conflict with Japan, and also the fracas with the UIR last year."
"Machiavelli?"
"That's pretty close. More a theoretician than a lead actor. The man behind the throne sort of guy. Not an ideologue per se, but a guy who likes to play in the real world."
"Patriot, Ed?" Ryan asked the DCI.
"We've had our shrink profile him." Foley shrugged. "Part sociopath, part political operator. A guy who enjoys the exercise of power. No known personal weaknesses. Sexually active, but a lot of their Politburo members are. Maybe it's a cultural thing, eh, Weaver?"
"Mao was like that, as we all know. The emperors used to have rather large stables of concubines."
"That's what people did before TV, I suppose," Arnie Van Damme observed.
"Actually, that's not far from the truth," Weaver agreed. "The carryover to today is cultural, and it's a fundamental form of personal power that some people like to exercise. Women's Lib hasn't made it into the PRC yet."
"I must be too Catholic," the president thought aloud. "The idea of Mao popping little girls makes my skin crawl."
"Oh, they didn't mind, Mr. President," Weaver told him. "Some would bring their little sisters over after they got in bed with the great leader. It's a different culture, and it has different rules from ours."
"Yeah, just a little different," observed the father of two daughters, one just starting to date. "What would the fathers of those barely nubile little girls have thought? Honored to have their daughters deflowered by the great Mao Zedong?" Ryan had a minor chill from the thought and dismissed it.
"Do they care about human life at all?"
What about their soldiers?
Mr. President, the Judeo-Christian Bible wasn't drafted in China, and efforts by missionaries to get Christianity going over there were not terribly successful. And when Mao came along, he suppressed it fairly effectively, as we saw again recently. Their view of man's place in nature is different from ours, and no, they do not value a single human life as we do. We're talking here about communists who view everything through a political lens, and that is over and above a culture in which a human life had little import. So you could say it's a very infelicitous confluence of belief systems from our point of view.
Infelicitous, Ryan thought. There's a delicate turn of phrase. We're talking about a government that killed off 20 million plus of its own people along the way, just in a few months, in pursuit of political perfection. Dr. Weaver, best guess, what's their Politburo going to say?
They will continue on the path they're on, Weaver answered quickly.
He was surprised at the reaction.
God damn it, doesn't anybody think common sense is going to break out? Ryan snarled.
He looked around the room to see people suddenly looking down at the royal blue rug.
Mr. President, they fear war less than they fear the alternatives to war, Weaver answered.
Rather courageously, Arnie Van Dam thought.
To repeat, if they don't enrich their country in oil and gold, they fear an economic collapse that will destroy their entire political order. And that, to them, is more frightening than the prospect of losing 100,000 soldiers in a war of conquest.
And I can stop it only by dropping a nuclear bomb on their capital, which will, by the way, kill a couple of million ordinary people. God damn it!
Ryan swore again.
More like 5 million, maybe as many as 10, General Moore pointed out, earning him a withering look from his commander-in-chief.
Yes, sir, that would work, but I agree the price of doing it's a little high.
Robbie?
Jack turned to his vice president in hope of hearing something encouraging.
What do you want me to say, Jack?
We can hope they realize that this is going to cost them more than they expect, but it would appear the odds are against it.
One other thing we need to do is prepare the people for this, Arnie said. Tomorrow we should alert the press, and then you'll have to go on TV and tell everybody what's happening and why.
You know, I really don't like this job very much.
Excuse me, that's rather a puerile thing to say, isn't it? Swordsman apologized.
Ain't supposed to be fun, Jack, Van Dam observed. You've played the game okay to this point, but you can't always control the other people at the card table.
The president's phone rang. Jack answered it.
Yes?
Okay. He looked up. Ed, it's for you. Foley stood and walked to take the phone.
Foley?
Okay, good, thanks.
He replaced the phone.
Weather's clearing over northeast China. We'll have some visual imagery in half an hour.
Mickey, how fast can we get aerial recon assets in place?
Jackson asked.
We have to fly them in. We have things we can stage out of California, but it's a lot more efficient to fly them over in a C-17 and lift them off from a Siberian airfield. We can do that in, 36 hours from your order.
The order is given, Ryan said.
What sort of aircraft are they?
They're UAVs, sir. Unmanned aerial vehicles. Used to call them drones. They're stealthy, and they stay up a long time. We can download real-time video from them. They're fabulous for battlefield reconnaissance, the best new toys the Air Force has fielded, so far as the Army is concerned. I can get them going right now.
Do it, Ryan told him.
Assuming we have a place to land them. But we could stage them out of Elmendorf in Alaska if we have to.
Moore lifted the phone and made his call to the National Military Command Center, the NMCC, in the Pentagon.
For General Peng, things were getting busy. The operation order was topped with the ideographs Long Chun, Spring Dragon. The dragon part sounded auspicious, since, for thousands of years, the dragon had been the symbol of imperial rule and also good fortune. There was still plenty of daylight. That suited Peng, and he hoped it would suit his soldiers. Daylight made for good hunting,
and made it harder for large bodies of men to hide or move unseen. And that suited his mission. He was not without misgivings. He was a general officer with orders to fight a war, and nothing makes such a man reflective like instructions to perform the things he'd claimed the ability to do. He would have preferred more artillery and air support, but he had a good deal of the former, and probably enough of the latter. At the moment he was going over intelligence estimates and maps. He'd studied the Russian defenses on the far side of the border for years, to the point of occasionally putting reconnaissance specialists across the river to scout out the bunkers that had faced south for 50 years. The Russians were good military engineers, and those fixed defenses would take some dealing with. But his attack plan was a simple one. Behind a massive artillery barrage, he'd put infantry across the Amur River in assault boats to deal with the Russian bunkers, simultaneously bringing up engineers to span the river with ribbon bridges in order to rush his mechanized forces across, up the hills on the far side, then farther north. He had helicopters, though not enough of the attack kind to suit his needs. He'd complained about this, but so had every other senior officer in the People's Liberation Army. The only thing about the Russian army that worried him were their Mi-24 attack helicopters. They were clumsy machines, but dangerous in their capabilities, if wisely used. His best intelligence came from reams of humint from Chinese citizens living illegally but comfortably in Russia. Shopkeepers and workers, a fair number of whom were officers or stringers for the Ministry for State Security. He would have preferred more photographs, but his country had only a single orbiting reconnaissance satellite, and the truth was that the imagery purchased from the French Spot Commercial Satellite Company was better, at 1 meter resolution, than his own country could manage. It was also easier to acquire over the Internet, and, for that, his intelligence coordinator had a blank check. They showed the nearest Russian mechanized formation over 100 kilometers away. That confirmed the human intelligence that had said only things within artillery range were garrison units assigned to the border defenses. It was interesting that the Russian high command had not surged forces forward, but they didn't have many to surge. And defending a border, with its numerous crenellations and meanders, used up manpower as a sponge used up water. And they didn't have that many troops to squander. He also possessed information that this General Colonel Bondarenko was training his troops harder than his predecessor had. But that was not much cause for concern. The Chinese had been training hard for years, and Ivan would take time to catch up. No, his only concern was distance. His army and its neighbors had a long way to go. Keeping them supplied would be a problem, because, as Napoleon said that an army marched on its stomach, so tanks and tracked vehicles floated on a sea of diesel oil. His intelligence sources gave locations for large Russian stocks, but he couldn't count on seizing them intact, desirable though that might be, and even though he had plans for helicopter assaults on every one he had charted. Peng put out his 60th cigarette of the day and looked up at his operations officer.
Yes?
The final order has arrived. Jump off at 0330 in 3 days. Will you have everything in place by then? Peng asked.
Yes, Comrade General, with 24 hours to spare.
Good. Let's make sure that all our men are well fed. It may be a long time between meals for the next few weeks.
That order has already been given, Comrade General, the Colonel told him.
And total radio silence.
Of course, Comrade General.
Not a whisper, the sergeant said. Not even carrier waves. The RC-135 rivet joint aircraft was the first USAF bird to deploy, flying out of Anderson Air Force Base on the island of Guam. It had refueled over the Sea of Okhotsk and entered Russian airspace over the port city of Ayan, and now, 2 hours later, was just east of Skovorodino on the Russian side of the border. The rivet joint was an extensively modified windowless version of the old Boeing 707, crammed with radio-receiving equipment and crewed with experienced ferret personnel. one of only two USAF crews who spoke passable Chinese.
"Sergeant, what's it mean when you have a lot of soldiers in the field and no radios?" the colonel in command of the mission asked. It was a rhetorical question, of course.
"Same thing it means when your two-year-old isn't making any noise, sir. He's crayoning the wall or doing something else to get his bottom smacked."
The sergeant leaned back in the pilot-type seat, looking at the numerous visual scans tuned to known PLA frequencies. The screen was blank except for mild static. Maybe there'd been some chatter as the PLA had moved units into place, but now there was nothing but some commercial FM traffic. Mainly music that was as alien to the American flight crew as Grand Ole Opry would have been in Beijing. Two crewmen listening to the civilian stations noted that the lyrics of the Chinese love ballads were as mindless as those of their Nashville counterparts, though the stations were leaning more heavily to patriotic songs at the moment. The same was noted at Fort Meade, Maryland. The National Security Agency had a lot of ferret satellites up and circling the globe, including two monster rhyolite types in geosynchronous orbit over the equator, and all were tuned to Chinese military and government channels. The FM radio chatter associated with military formations had trended down to zero in the last 12 hours, and to the uniformed and civilian analysts alike, that meant just one thing. A quiet army is an army planning to do something. The people at the National Reconnaissance Office had the main tasking in finishing up a special national intelligence estimate, because people tended to believe photographs more than mere words. The imagery had been computer-matched with the radar imaging satellites' take, but surprisingly to no one, the assembly areas were mostly empty now. The tanks and other tracked vehicles had lingered only long enough to get reorganized after the train trip, and had moved out north, judging by the ruts they'd left in the mainly dirt roads of the region. They'd taken the time to spread their camouflage nets over the redeployed tanks, but that too had been a pro forma waste of time, because they could as little hide the track marks of hundreds of such vehicles as they could hide a mountain range. And scarcely any such effort had been taken with the hundreds of supply trucks, which, they saw, were still moving in tight little convoys, at about 30 kilometers per hour, heading for assembly areas just a few clicks south of where the shooters were. The imagery was printed up on six of the big laser printers custom-made for the NRO, and driven to the White House, where people were mainly sitting around in the Oval Office pulling a presidential all-nighter, which was rather more special than those done by the delivery man, an Army Sergeant E-5 in this case. The civilian analyst who'd come with him stayed inside while the NCO walked back out to the government Ford sedan, having left behind a Newport 100mm cigarette for the president.
"Jack, you're bad," Jackson observed, bumming a smoke off that innocent young boy.
"Stick it, Robbie," POTUS replied with a grin.
The smoke made him cough, but it helped him stay awake as much as the premium coffee did.
"You handle the stress your way, I'll handle it my way."
"Okay, what do we have here?" the president asked the senior analyst.
"Sir, this is as many armored vehicles in one area as I've ever seen in China, plus all their equipment. They're going north, and soon. In less than 3 days, I'd say."
"What about air?" Jackson asked.
"Right here, sir."
The analyst's finger traced over one of the photos. "Dedicated fighter base at Jinshi is a good example. Here's a squadron of Russian-made Su-27s, plus a whole regiment of J-7s. The Sukhoi's a pretty good fighter plane, similar in mission and capabilities to an early F-15. The 7's a day fighter knockoff of the old MiG-21, modified for ground attack as well as mixing up in the furball. You can count 68 aircraft. Probably at least 4 were in the air when the satellite went overhead. Note the fueling trucks right on the ramp, and this aircraft has ground crew tinkering with it. We estimate that this base was stood down for 5 days.
"Getting everything ready?" Jackson asked.
"That's how people did it."
"Yes, sir. You will also note missile noses peeking out under the wings of all these aircraft. They appear to be loaded for combat."
"White ones on the rails," Robbie observed. "They're planning to go do some work."
"Unless our note gets them to calm down," Ryan said, with a minor degree of hope in his voice.
A very minor note, the others in the room thought. The president got one last puff off the purloined Newport and stubbed it out.
"Might it help for me to make a direct personal call to Premier Xu?"
"Honest answer?"
It was Professor Weaver, rather the worse for wear at 4 in the Washington morning.
"The other sort isn't much use to me at the moment," Ryan replied, not quite testily.
"It will look good in the papers and maybe the history books, but it is unlikely to affect their decision-making process."
"It's worth a try," Ed Foley said in disagreement. "What do we have to lose?"
"Wait until 8, Jack," Van Dam thought. "We don't want him to think we've been up all night. It'll inflate his sense of self-worth."
Ryan turned to look at the windows on his south wall. The drapes hadn't been closed, and anyone passing by could have noted that the lights had been on all night. But strangely, he didn't know if the Secret Service ever turned them off at night.
"When do we start moving forces?" Jack asked next.
"The air attaché will call from Moscow when his talks have been concluded. Ought to be any time."
The president grunted.
"Longer night than ours."
"He's younger than we are," Mickey Moore observed. "Just a colonel."
"If this goes, what are our plans like?" Van Dam asked.
"Hyperwar," Moore answered.
"The world doesn't know the new weapons we've been developing. It'll make Desert Storm look like slow motion."
Chapter 48 Opening Guns. While others were pulling all-nighters, Gennady Yosifovich Bondarenko was forgetting what sleep was supposed to have been. His teleprinter was running hot with dispatches from Moscow, reading that occupied his time, and not always to his profit. Russia had still not learned to leave people alone when they were doing their jobs, and as a result, his senior communications officer cringed when he came in with new flash traffic.
"Look," the general said to his intelligence officer, "what I need is information on what equipment they have, where they are, and how they are postured to move north on us. Their politics and objectives are not as important to me as where they are right now."
"I expect to have hard information from Moscow momentarily. It will be American satellite coverage and..."
"God damn it! I remember when we had our own fucking satellites! What about aerial reconnaissance?"
"The proper aircraft are on their way to us now. We'll have them flying by tomorrow noon, but do we dare send them over Chinese territory?" Colonel Tolkunov asked.
"Do we dare not to?" Sink Far East demanded in reply.
"General,"
the G2 said, "the concern is that we would be giving the Chinese a political excuse for the attack."
"Who said that?"
"Stavka."
Bondarenko's head dropped over the map table. He took a breath and closed his eyes for 3 blissful seconds. But all that achieved was to make him wish for an hour. No, just 30 minutes of sleep. That's all, he thought. Just 30 minutes.
"A political excuse," the general observed.
"You know, Vladimir Konstantinovich, once upon a time the Germans were sending high-flying reconnaissance aircraft deep into western Russia, scouting us out prior to their invasion. There was a special squadron of fighters able to reach their altitude, and their regimental commander asked for permission to intercept them. He was relieved of his command on the spot. I suppose he was lucky that he wasn't shot. He ended up a major ace and a hero of the Soviet Union before some German fighter got him. You see, Stalin was afraid of provoking Hitler, too."
"Comrade Colonel?" Heads turned. It was a young sergeant with an armful of large-format photographs.
"Here, quickly."
The sergeant laid them on the table, obscuring the topographical maps that had occupied the previous 4 hours. The quality wasn't good. The imagery had been transmitted over a fax machine instead of a proper photographic printer. But it was good enough for their purposes. There were even inserts, small white boxes with legends typed in English, to tell the ignorant what was in the pretty little pictures.
The intelligence officer was the first to make sense of it all.
"Here they come," the colonel breathed.
He checked the coordinates and the time indicated in the lower right corner of the top photo.
"That's a complete tank division. And it's right..." He turned back to the printed map.
"Right here, just as we expected.
Their marshalling point is Harbin."
"Well, it had to be.
All their rail lines converge there. Their first objective will be Belogorsk."
"And right up the valley from there," Bondarenko agreed. "Through this pass, then northwest." One didn't need to be a Nobel laureate to predict a line of advance. The terrain was the prime objective condition to which all ambitions and plans had to bend. Bondarenko could read the mind of the enemy commander well enough, because any trained soldier would see the contour lines on the map and analyze them the same way. Flat was better than sloped. Clear was better than wooded. Dry was better than wet. There was a lot of sloped terrain on the border, but it smoothed out, and there were too many valleys inviting speedy advance. With enough troops, he could have made every one of those valleys a death trap. But if he'd had enough troops, the Chinese wouldn't be lined up on his border. They'd be sitting in their own prepared defenses, fearing him. But that was not the shape of the current world for Commander-in-Chief Far East. The 265th Motor Rifle was 100 kilometers back from the border. The troops were undergoing frantic gunnery training now, because that would generate the most rapid return for investment. The battalion and regimental officers were in their command posts running map table exercises, because Bondarenko needed them thinking, not shooting. He had sergeants for that. The good news for Bondarenko was that his soldiers enjoyed shooting live rounds, and their skill levels were improving rapidly. The bad news was that for every trained tank crew he had, the Chinese had over 20.
"What an ambush we could lay, if we only had the men," Tolkunov breathed.
"When I was in America watching them train, I heard a good if-only joke. If only your aunt had balls, then she'd be your uncle, Vladimir Konstantinovich."
"Quite so, Comrade General."
They both turned back to the maps and the photos.
"So they know what we are doing," Chan Kun observed. "This is not a good development."
"You can know what a robber will do, but if he has a pistol and you don't, what difference does it make?" Zhang Hansan asked in return.
"Comrade Marshal?"
"One cannot hide so large a movement of troops," Marshal Luo said blandly. "Tactical surprise is always hard to achieve. But we do have strategic surprise."
"That is true," Tan Deshi told the Politburo. "The Russians have alerted some of their divisions for movement, but they are all in the west, and days away, and all will approach down this rail line, and our air force can close it, can't you, Luo?"
"Easily," the defense minister agreed.
"And what of the Americans?" Fang Gan asked.
"In that note we just got, they have told us that they regard the Russians as allies. How many times have people underestimated the Americans, Zhang?"
"Including yourself," he added.
"There are objective conditions which apply even to the Americans, for all their magic," Luo assured the assembly.
"And in 3 years we will be selling them oil and gold," Zhang assured them all in turn.
"The Americans have no political memory. They always adapt to the changing shape of the world. In 1949 they drafted the NATO Treaty, which included their bitter enemies in Germany. Look at what they did with Japan after dropping atomic bombs on them. The only thing we should consider, though few Americans will be deployed, and they will have to take their chances along with everyone else, perhaps we should avoid inflicting too many casualties. We would also do well to treat prisoners and captured civilians gently. The world does have sensibilities we must regard somewhat, I suppose."
"Comrades," Fang said, summoning up his courage for one last display of his inner feelings. "We still have the chance to stop this from happening, as Marshal Luo told us some days ago. We are not fully committed until shots are fired. Until then we can say we were running a defense exercise, and the world will go along with that explanation,
for the reasons my friend Zhang has just told us. But once hostilities are begun, the tiger is out of the cage. Men defend what is theirs with tenacity. You will recall that Hitler underestimated the Russians, to his ultimate sorrow. Iran underestimated the Americans just last year, causing disaster for them and the death of their leader. "Are we sure that we can prevail in this adventure?" he asked. "Sure. We gamble with the life of our country here. We ought not to forget that." "Fang, my old comrade, you are wise and thoughtful as ever," Zhang responded graciously. "And I know you speak on behalf of our nation and our people. But as we must not underestimate our enemies, so we ought not to underestimate ourselves. We fought the Americans once before, and we gave them the worst military defeat in their history, did we not?" "Yes, we did surprise them, but in the end we lost 1 million men, including Mao's own son. And why? Because we overestimated our own abilities." "Not this time, Fang," Luo assured them all. "Not this time. We will do to the Russians the same thing we did to the Americans at the Yalu River. We will strike with power and surprise. Where they are weak, we will rush through. Where they are strong, we will encircle and surround. In 1950, we were a peasant army with only light weapons. Today," Luo went on, "we are a fully modern army. We can do things today such as even the Americans could not dream of back then. We will prevail," the defense minister concluded with firm conviction. "Comrades, do we wish to stop now?" Zhang asked, to focus the debate. "Do we wish to doom our country's economic and political future? For that is the issue at hand. If we stand still, we risk national death. Who among us wishes to stand still then?" Predictably, no one, not even Qian, moved to pick up that gauntlet. The vote was entirely pro forma and unanimous. As always, the Politburo achieved collegiality for its own sake. The ministers returned to their various offices. Zhang buttonholed Tan Deshi for several minutes before heading back to his. An hour after that, he dropped in on his friend Fang Gan. "You are not cross with me?" Fang asked. "The voice of caution is something that does not offend me, my old friend," Zhang said, graciously taking his seat opposite the other's desk. He could afford to be gracious. He had won. "I am afraid of this move, Zhang. We did underestimate the Americans in 1950, and it cost us many men." "We have the men to spare," the senior minister without portfolio pointed out. "And it will make Luo feel valuable." "As if he needs that." Fang gestured his displeasure with that strutting martinet. "Even a dog has his uses," his visitor pointed out. "Zhang, what if the Russians are more formidable than you think?" "I've taken care of that. We will create instability in their country in 2 days, the very day our attack begins."
"How?"
"You'll recall we had that failed attempt against Grushevoy's senior advisor, that Golovko fellow." "Yes, and I counseled against that too," Fang reminded his visitor. "And there, perhaps you were right," Zhang acknowledged, to smooth his host's feathers. "But Tan has developed the capability, and what better way to destabilize Russia than to eliminate their president? This we can do, and Tan has his orders."
"You assassinate a government chief in a foreign land?" Fang asked, surprised at this level of boldness. "What if you fail?"
"We commit an act of war against Russia anyway. What have we to lose by this?"
"Nothing.
But there is much to gain."
"But the political implications," Fang breathed.
"What of them?"
"What if they turn the tables on us?"
"You mean attempt to attack Xu personally?" The look on his face provided the real answer to the question. "China would be better off without the nonentity,"
But even Zhang would not say that aloud, even in the privacy of this room. Tan assures me that our physical security is perfect. Perfect, Fang. There are no foreign intelligence operations of consequence in our country. I suppose every nation says such a thing. Right before the roof caves in on them. We've done well with our spying in America, for example, and for that our good comrade Tan is to be congratulated. But arrogance falls before the blow, and such blows are never anticipated. We would do well to remember that. Zhang dismissed the thought. One cannot fear everything. That is true, but to fear nothing is also imprudent. Fang paused to mend fences. Zhang, you must think me an old woman. That made the other minister smile. Old woman? No, Fang, you are a comrade of many years standing, and one of our most thoughtful thinkers. Why do you suppose I brought you on to the Politburo? To get my votes, of course. Fang didn't answer. He had the utmost respect for his senior colleague, but he wasn't blind to his faults. For that I am grateful. For that the people ought to be grateful. You are so solicitous to their needs. Well, one must remember the peasants and workers out there. We serve them, after all. The ideological cant was just perfect for the moment. This is not an easy job we share. You need to relax a little. Get that girl Ming out there. Take her to your bed. You've done it before. It was a weakness both men shared. The tension of the moment abated, as Zhang wished it to. Chai sucks better, Fang replied, with a sly look. Then take her to your flat. Buy her some silk drawers. Get her drunk. They all like that. Not a bad idea, Fang agreed. It certainly helps me sleep. Then do it, by all means. We'll need our sleep. The next few weeks will be strenuous for us, but more so for our enemies. One thing, Zhang. As you said, we must treat the captives well. One thing the Americans do not forgive rapidly is cruelty to the helpless, as we have seen here in Beijing. Now, they are old women. They do not understand the proper use of strength. Perhaps so, but if we wish to do business with them, as you say, why offend them unnecessarily? Zhang sighed and conceded the point, because he knew it to be the smart play. Very well. I will tell Luo. He checked his watch. I must be off. I'm having dinner with Xu tonight. Give him my best wishes? Of course. Zhang rose, bowed to his friend, and took his leave. Fang took a minute or so before rising and walking to the door. Ming, he called on opening it, come here. He lingered at the door as the secretary came in, allowing his eyes to linger on Chai. Their eyes met, and she winked, adding a tiny feminine smile. Yes, he needed his sleep tonight, and she would help. The Politburo meeting ran late this day, Fang said, settling into his chair and doing his dictation. It took 25 minutes, and he dismissed Ming to do her daily transcription. Then he had Chai come in, gave her an order, and dismissed her. In another hour the working day ended. Fang walked down to his official car with Chai in trail. Together they rode to his comfortable apartment, and there they got down to business. Ming met her lover at a new restaurant called the Jade Horse, where the food was better than average. "You look troubled," Nomori observed. "Busy time at the office," she explained. "There is big trouble to come."
"Oh, what sort of trouble?"
"I cannot say," she demurred. "It will probably not affect your company." And Nomori saw that he'd taken his agent to the next, actually the last, step.
She no longer thought about the software on her office computer. He never brought the subject up. Better that it should happen below the visible horizon. Better that she should forget what she was doing. Your conscience doesn't worry about things you've forgotten. After dinner, they walked back to Nomori's place, and the CIA officer tried his best to relax her. He was only partially successful, but she was properly appreciative and left him at 10:45. Nomori had himself a nightcap, a double, and checked to make sure his computer had relayed her almost daily report. Next week he hoped to have software he could cross-load to hers over the net, so that she'd be transmitting the reports directly out to the recipe network. If bad things were happening in Beijing, NEC might call him back to Japan. And he didn't want Songbird's reports to stop going to Langley. As it happened, this one was already there, and it had generated all manner of excitement. It was enough to make Ed Foley wish he'd lent a stew to Sergei Golovko. But America didn't give away its communication secrets that readily. And so the report had been redrafted and sent by SecureFax to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, then hand-carried to SVR headquarters by a consular officer not associated with the CIA. Of course, now they'd assume that he was a spook, which would cause the Russians to shadow him everywhere he went, and use up trained personnel of the FSS. Business was still business, even in this new world order. Golovko predictably bounced hard off his high office ceiling. John Clark got the news over his secure satellite phone. "What the hell?" Rainbow Six asked, sitting still in his personal car not far from Red Square. "You heard me," Ed Foley explained. "Okay, now what?" "You're tight with their special operations people, right?"
"Somewhat," Clark allowed.
"We're training them." "Well, they might come to you for advice of some sort. You have to know what's happening."
"Can I tell Ding?"
"Yes," the DCI agreed.
"Good.
You know this proves the Chavez premise."
"What's that?" Foley asked.
"He likes to say that international relations is largely composed of one nation fucking another." It was enough to make Foley laugh, 5,000 miles and 8 time zones away. "Well, our Chinese friends are sure playing rough."
"How good is the information?"
"It's holy writ, John. Take it to the bank," Ed assured his distant field officer.
"We have some source in Beijing," Clark didn't observe aloud.
"Okay, Ed. If they come to me, I'll let you know." "We cooperate, I presume?"
"Fully," the DCI assured him.
"We're allies now. Didn't you see CNN?"
"I thought it was the Sci-Fi Channel."
"You ain't the only one. Have a good one, John."
"You too, Ed. Bye."
Clark thumbed the end button and went on just to himself. Holy jumpin' Jesus. Then he restarted the car and headed off to his rendezvous with Domingo Chavez. Ding was at the bar that Rainbow had adopted during its stay in the Moscow area. The boys congregated in a large corner booth, where they complained about the local beer, but appreciated the clear alcohol preferred by the natives.
"Hey, Mr. C," Chavez said in greeting.
"Just got a call from Ed on my portable."
"And?"
"And John Chinaman is planning to start a little war with our hosts.
And that's the good news," Clark added.
"What the fuck is the bad news?" Chavez asked, with no small incredulity in his voice.
"Their Ministry of State Security just put a contract out on Edward Petrovich," John went on.
"Are they fucking crazy?" the other CIA officer asked the booth.
"Well, starting a war in Siberia isn't exactly a rational act. Ed let us in because he thinks the locals might want our help soon. Supposedly they know the local contact for the Chi-Coms. You have to figure a hot takedown's going to evolve from this, and we've been training their troopies. I figure we might be invited in to watch, but they probably won't want us to assist."
"Agreed.
That's when General Karelin came in, with a sergeant at his side. The sergeant stood by the door with his overcoat unbuttoned and his right hand close to the opening. The senior officer spotted Clark and came directly over.
"I don't have your cell phone number."
"What do you want us for today, General?" Clark asked.
"I need for you to come with me. We have to see Chairman Golovko."
"Do you mind if Domingo comes along?"
"That is fine," Karelin replied. "I've talked to Washington recently."
"How much do you know?" Clark asked his Russian friend.
"Much, but not all. That's why we need to see Golovko."
Karelin waved them to the door, where his sergeant was doing his best Doberman imitation.
"Something happening?" Eddie Price asked.
No one was guarding his expression, and Price knew how to read faces.
"Tell you when we get back," Chavez told him.
The staff car waiting outside had a chase car with four men in it, and the sergeant-slash-bodyguard accompanying the general was one of the few enlisted men who'd been let into the cross-training that Rainbow had been running. The Russians, they knew, were coming along very well. It didn't hurt to draw people hand-selected from an already elite unit. The cars moved through Moscow traffic with less than the usual regard for traffic and safety laws, then pulled into the main gate at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. The elevator was held for them, and they made the top floor in a hurry.
"Thank you for coming so quickly. I assume you've spoken with Langley," Golovko observed.
Clark held up his cell phone.
"The encryption unit is so small."
"Progress, Chairman," Clark observed. "I'm told this intelligence information is to be taken seriously."
"Folieva has a fine source in Beijing. I've seen some of the take from him. It would appear first that a deliberate attempt was made on my life, and now another is planned for President Grushevoy. I've already notified him. His security people are fully alerted. The Chinese lead agent in Moscow has been identified and is under surveillance. When he receives his instructions, we will arrest him. But we do not know who his contacts are. We assume they are former Spetsnaz people loyal to him, criminals, of course, doing special work for the underworld we've grown up here."
That made sense, John thought.
"Some people will do anything for money, Sergei Nikolaevich. How can we help you?"
"Foley has instructed you to assist."
"Good of him. Given the nature of how the intelligence came to us, an American observer seems appropriate. For the takedown, we will use police, with cover from General Kirillin's people. As Rainbow Commander, this will be your task."
Clark nodded. It wasn't all that demanding.
"Fair enough."
"We'll keep you safe," the general assured him.
"And you expect the Chinese to launch a war on Russia?"
"Within the week," Golovko nodded.
"The oil and the gold?" Chavez asked.
"So it would seem."
"Well, that's life in the big city," Ding observed.
"We will make them regret this barbaric act," Karelin told everyone present.
"That remains to be seen," Golovko cautioned. He knew what Bondarenko was saying to Stavka.
"And with you guys in NATO, we are coming to help out?" Clark asked.
"Your President Ryan is a true comrade," the Russian agreed.
"That means Rainbow too, then," John thought aloud. "We're all NATO troopers."
"Ain't never fought in a real war before," Chavez thought aloud.
But now he was a simulated major, and he might just get drafted into this one. His life insurance, he remembered, was fully paid up.
"It's not exactly fun, Domingo," Clark assured him.
"And I'm getting a little old for this shit." The Chinese embassy was under continuous and expert surveillance by a large team of officers from the Russian Federal Security Service. Almost all of them were formerly of the KGB's Second Chief Directorate. Reconstituted under a new agency's aegis, they performed the same function as the FBI's intelligence division, and they gave away little to their American counterparts. No fewer than 20 of them were assigned to this task. They comprised all physical types, male and female, prosperous and impoverished-looking, middle-aged and old. But no really young ones, because this case was too important for inexperienced officers. The vehicles assigned to the task included everything from dump trucks to motorbikes, and every mobile group had at least one radio, of types so advanced that the Russian army didn't have them yet. Kong Dixi emerged from the PRC embassy at 7:40. He walked to the nearest metro station and took the escalator down. This was entirely routine. At the same time, another minor consular officer left and headed in a different direction. But the FSS officers didn't know to watch him. He walked 3 blocks to the second lamppost on a busy street, and, passing it, he pulled a strip of white paper tape from his coat pocket and stuck it vertically on the metal post. Then he walked on to a restaurant and had dinner alone, having fulfilled a mission whose purpose he didn't know. He was the flagman for the MSS in the embassy, but was not a trained intelligence officer. Third Secretary Kong rode the train for the proper number of stops and got off, with 4 FSS officers in trail, another one waiting in the station, and 2 more at the top of the long escalator to the surface. Along the way, he purchased a newspaper from one of the kiosks on the street. Twice he stopped, once to light a cigarette, and the other time to look around as if lost and trying to get his bearings. Both efforts, of course, were to spot a tail. But the FSS people were too numerous, some too near, and the close ones studiously, but not too studiously, looking elsewhere. The truth of the matter, as known to the FBI and the British Security Service as well, is that once a contact is identified, he is as naked and helpless as a newborn in the jungle, as long as those shadowing him are not total fools. These KGB-trained professionals were anything but fools. The only thing they didn't know was the identity of the flagman, but that, as usual, was something you might never get. The problem there was that you never knew how quickly to get the dead drop that was about to be made. The other problem for the control agent, Kong Dixi, was that once the location of the dead drop was identified, it was as easily watched as the single cloud in an otherwise clear sky. The size of the surveillance troop was just to make sure there wasn't another drop. And there wasn't. Kong sat down on the expected bench. Here he violated Fieldcraft by acting as though he could read a newspaper in the diminishing light. But as there was a street lamp close by, it wouldn't tip off the casual onlooker. "There," one of the FSS men observed. Kong's right hand made the emplacement. 3 minutes later, he folded his paper and strolled off, in the same direction he'd been heading. The FSS detail let him go a long way before they moved in. Again it was done from a van, and again the locksmith was inside and waiting with the custom-made key. Also in the van was a high-end American laptop computer with the one-time cipher pad pre-programmed in, an exact copy of Suvorov/Konyev's desktop machine in his upscale flat on the Ring Road. And so, the senior FSS officer on the case thought, their quarry was like a tiger prowling through the jungle with 10 unknown rifles aimed at it. Powerful and dangerous, perhaps, but utterly doomed. The transfer case was delivered. The locksmith popped it open. The contents were unfolded and photocopied, then replaced, and the case was resealed and returned to its spot on the metal plate under the bench. Already a typist was keying in the random letters of the message, and inside of 4 minutes the clear text came up.
"Jobbt for your mutt," the senior officer observed. "They want him to kill President Grushevoy."
"What is that?" a junior officer asked. The case leader just handed over the laptop computer and let him read the screen.
"This is an act of war," the major breathed. The colonel nodded.
"It is that, Grigory." And the van pulled away. He had to report this and do it immediately. Lieutenant Provolov was home when the call came. He grumbled the usual amount as he redressed and headed to FSS headquarters. He hadn't grown to love the Federal Security Service, but he had come to respect it. With such resources, he thought, he could end crime in Moscow entirely. But they didn't share resources, and they retained the above-the-law arrogance their antecedent agency had once displayed. Perhaps it was necessary. The things they investigated were no less serious than murder, except in scale. Traitors killed not individuals, but entire regions. Treason was a crime that had been taken seriously in his country for centuries, and one that his nation's long-standing institutional paranoia had always feared as much as it had hated. They were burning more than the usual amount of midnight oil here, Provolov saw. Yefremov was standing in his office, reading a piece of paper with the sort of blank look on his face that frequently denoted something monstrous.
"Good evening, Pavel Georgievich."
"Lieutenant Provolov. Here." Yefremov handed over the paper.
"Our subject grows ambitious. Or at least his controllers do."
The militia lieutenant took the page and read it quickly, then returned to the top to give it a slower redigestion.
"When did this happen?"
"Less than an hour ago."
"What observations do you make?"
"We should arrest him at once," the cop said predictably.
"I thought you'd say that.
But instead we will wait and see whom he contacts. Then we will snatch him up. But first I want to see the people he notifies."
"What if he does it from a cell phone or a payphone?"
"Then we will have the telephone company identify them for us. But I want to see if he has a contact within an important government office. Suvorov had many colleagues where he was in KGB. I want to know which of them have turned mercenary, so that we can root all of them out." The attack on Sergei Nikolaevich displayed a frightening capability. "I want to put an end to it, to scoop that all up, and send them all to a labor camp of strict regime." The Russian penal system had three levels of camps. Those of mild regime were unpleasant. The medium ones were places to avoid. But those of strict regime were hell on earth. They were particularly useful for getting the recalcitrant to speak of things they preferred to keep quiet about in ordinary circumstances. Yefremov had the ability to control which scale of punishment a man earned. Suvorov already merited death in Russia, usually delivered by a bullet. But there were worse things than death.
"The President's security detail has been warned?"
The FSS officer nodded.
"Yes, though that was a tender one. How can we be sure that one of them is not compromised?
That nearly happened to the American president last year, you may have heard, and it is a possibility we have to consider. They are all being watched. But Suvorov had few contacts with the Eighth Directorate when he was KGB, and none of the people he knew ever switched over to there."
"You are sure of that?"
"We finished the cross-check 3 days ago. We've been busy checking records. We even have a list of people Suvorov might call. 16 of them, in fact. All of their phones have been tapped, and all are being watched." But even the FSS didn't have the manpower to put full surveillance details on those potential suspects. This had become the biggest case in the history of the FSS, and few of the KGB's investigations had used up this much manpower, even back to Oleg Penkovsky.
"What about the names Amalric and Zimyanin?"
"Zimyanin came up in our check, but not the other. Suvorov didn't know him, but Zimyanin did. They were comrades in Afghanistan, and presumably recruited the other himself. Of the 16 others, 7 are prime suspects, all Spetsnaz, 3 officers and 4 non-coms, all of them people who've put their talent and training on the open market. 2 are in St. Petersburg, and might have been implicated in the elimination of Amalric and Zimyanin.